So you've been on the, you know, the,
I guess you're in the middle of a tour.
I'm in the middle of it, yes. Yes, it's like being in the middle of the ocean.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, because there, because it becomes very much, if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium. So John Gregory Dunn once told a story about being in a cab and saying, I didn't know that Pittsburgh had one of those arches. And the man said, you're in St. Louis. And it does have that feeling. Toronto did not seem to me different intrinsically from New York or Boston.
That's why they're making all the these movies in Toronto now.
That's right, exactly, because it's kind of a generic eastern city. Exactly, it was a generic winter day yesterday.
Did you do what? Did you do the broadcast?
Yes, I did the their Canada AM show, which is their Today show, and I did a big radio show in Toronto, and I gave a reading. Partly this tour is being constructed around readings in bookstores, which is very important for me to kind of connect up to the community.
Mm-hmm. So you have some readings scheduled here in New York?
I did one at the West Side Y last Friday night with three other writers.
Well, let's go back a little bit, because there is a precedent to the to Afterlife, and I guess that's the Borrowed Time, which I see is now just out in paperback. Why don't we start with that book a little bit? Tell me about that book and this terrible experience that you had.
Well, Borrowed Time was an attempt on my part to leave a record for the future. I wasn't at all certain that I was writing a book for people who are going through the calamity now, because I couldn't imagine that people going through it now would want to read about it. My friend Roger died in October 1986, and he had been ill for 20 terrible months, and Borrowed Time is a kind of chronicle of those 20 months. The model in my head was a kind of double model. I wanted to try to get the kind of heartbeat of a book like Death Be Not Proud, a book that I used to teach eighth graders when I was a teacher in my 20s, and I wanted to get maybe the drum beat of a book like Michael Hare's Dispatches, i.e. giving a kind of front-line picture of the war we found ourselves in. So Borrowed Time chronicles Roger's illness from onset until death, but by the same token tries to take the temper of the times and tries to talk about the plague of fear and intolerance that has gone along with it.
Did you, as you wrote this book, did you divorce yourself emotionally from what you were writing? You probably have to do that, wouldn't you?
Curiously, Don, I don't think it was that painful to write during most of the time. I think the whole experience of it was cathartic, and it was certainly what I did with my grief. The last 50 or 60 pages was like dying all over again, or watching Roger die all over again. That was certainly true. And finishing it was a terrible experience. I guess I thought after Roger died that I would be gone within 3 months or 6 months or a year. I had watched too many of my friends die. I knew that my own immune system was compromised, and I just didn't feel there was any time to wait. The way in which Borrowed Time was written was that I would get up in the morning and I would write it all day long, and when I went to bed at night, I would have to have a sense in my mind that wherever I had gotten to at that point at night might be the last point it would ever get to, because I could wake up in the next morning with a hammering headache and that would be a lymphoma, and I would be gone in a week. Though that turned out not to be true, that's how I felt all the time I was writing it. I felt I was writing it with bombs bursting all around me. I turned out to be wrong on that count, and I've had a chance to live on with this window of life in which I've been able to write more about AIDS. And also, the book that I thought I was writing for the future, for my people, for gay and lesbian people, so that they would know who we were, so that they would not believe the lies of history or the distortions of history. My model there was Primo Levi, who kept writing book after book about his experience in Auschwitz in order to constantly refine his own ethics and refine his own clarity about history. Because after all, he lived long enough to watch the capos of the camps write their memoirs and distance themselves from what had happened. It turned out that borrowed time really was a sort of lightning rod for a lot of people, and it did turn out to be that curious phenomenon that we talk about in gay and lesbian literature of the crossover book. A lot of straight people read it. A lot of mothers and sisters and brothers and children and students of people who died of AIDS read that book and wrote to me. I mean, I got hundreds of letters about borrowed time. So it was a very special phenomenon, and I was not prepared for it. And I'm still not quite prepared for the mail that I get and the wrenching stories that people tell me.
I have this theory that in some respects fiction can tell you things that you cannot say in nonfiction. For example, in your memoir, there were probably things that you would not want to say or could not say. In fiction, you can get deeper into the heart of a person and the emotions and even become more explicit in terms of, well, in some of the scenes, there are some graphic sex scenes in Afterlife that probably would not be appropriate in a memoir like Borrowed Time. So I say that speculating that Afterlife gives you an opportunity to say more and get even more deeply into this problem. Is that a correct assumption?
It certainly has. To approach AIDS by way of fiction certainly gave me a chance to broaden my perspective, so that it was not just my perspective. I consciously chose to tell the story of three different men, all AIDS widowers, all people who had lost their lovers to AIDS in the previous year. One of whom lives in an enormous amount of denial and who continues a life of compulsive sexuality in the hopes that he can just wish it all away. One of whom becomes an AIDS terrorist because his rage consumes him. And the third of those characters is the one who is most modeled on me, the character of Stephen. And he is the one who yearns for another connection. He yearns for intimacy again.
But there's a fourth character, too. It's really about four people.
Because you're speaking of the... right, exactly. You're speaking
although
of the
Mark
man he falls in love with.
Yeah.
And the relationship that they are able to bond with, Stephen and Mark, is the love story that I meant Afterlife to be at its most joyous. It's a complicated love story because everyone in Afterlife is ticking. Everyone is seropositive to the virus, and everyone is constantly opening their pill timers and taking their antiviral drugs. And the black humor, I think, accumulates around all of the dying that they still have to witness.
One of the characters in the book, I can't remember which one, says something to the effect that virtually everyone they know is dying of the disease, except for some of the very youngest. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, Larry Kramer says that he's lost 500 people to AIDS, and that always seems the largest number anyone's ever told me. I suppose that I know 100 to 150 people who have died of AIDS, and I probably know another 100 to 200 people struggling with HIV at one level or another. The key thing for me is that the two or three people who have meant most to me in my life have died of AIDS, and the person who means most to me now has AIDS. So I'm not ever far from that battleground, but on the other hand, I don't wish to be. There are friends who well-meaningly can't quite understand how I can be in a relationship now with someone who has AIDS. Well, I didn't choose that to happen. It just happened that Stephen got sick after we met. But I don't feel extra cheated by it all. One of the things that my grief left me with was a strong sense of wanting whatever life is left to me to mean something. Writing is the best way I can try to mean something, but my writing has become more and more political, for want of a better word, but more and more engaged with a kind of challenge to the homophobia in the society. nonetheless, I'm a writer of love stories. I think I always have been at one level, and it was very important to me that Afterlife be a joyous story of two people coming together. The character of Stephen has lost someone. The character of Mark has never been able to love anyone. He's been a television executive, mired in his own narcissism through most of his adult life. And there's a lot of things they need to break down before they can come together.
The term that you use, widow, is that widely used?
It's a bit lightly used. The kind of buzz phrase of AIDS widowers is something in a way that we bandy about, my editor and I, and yet it's light and grave at the same time, as is so much of the humor with which we approach the catastrophe. I suppose that there's a certain amount of caustic humor even in borrowed time, to the extent that I ever refer to anyone in Hollywood, and when I refer to that cesspool, I usually have something caustic to say. But much more consciously in Afterlife, I wanted to play with some of this, even though much of the terms of what I'm dealing with and the death that happens in it, for instance, there's a kind of comic, an impish comic energy in me when I'm writing. I just feel that.
I can see that very much, particularly in the scenes in which I believe the character, the Korean Ray, I believe his name is, appears.
Right.
And here we are watching Ray's death, and yet it is, that's a good term, impish.
In terms of the mystery of how a novel gets written, Don, that character of Ray was always in the book, but I announced to any number of people when I was writing Afterlife, you know, no one's going to die of AIDS in this book. I have done death by AIDS in a book of poems and in a memoir, and I really want to talk about people living with the virus. And the character of Ray really crept up on me and became more and more important. At a certain point in the writing, it became clear to me that, in fact, someone was going to die, and we were going to see their reactions to that death. But the novel, plotted though it was in my head, in terms of my three or four major characters, I wasn't sure entirely where it was going until I was writing it.
There's one thing that that troubled me a little bit, and it's not a flaw in the book. It deals with the relationship, the sexual relationship of gays, because you have several sex scenes in the book that seem so clinical. Now, I could be wrong about this, but it seems that heterosexual sex seems to be romantic. I mean, there is a string orchestra in the background, and there's a roaring fireplace or a crackling fireplace, and there's a bottle of wine, and maybe some waves crashing softly on the beach. But in Afterlife, the sex scenes seem as though they are done under a ceiling light. Now, is this an accurate perception of gay sex?
It's a very interesting question. I've been thinking about your asking about the erotic scenes ever since you mentioned them at the beginning, because they are very startling, and they are very graphic. There are two kinds of eroticism in Afterlife. I can't speak to how clinical they are, but I know that there's one 40-page scene about sexual dysfunction. The first scene when Mark and Stephen really come together physically, Stephen can't perform. And I have to tell you, during the 40-page, maybe it's not 40 pages, it felt like 400 pages when I wrote it, I have to tell you, because I have heard so much about sexual dysfunction from so many people in the age of AIDS. And in that, I speak of gay and straight alike. So many people have become so blasted by their fear of AIDS that it has really frightened them in the sexual arena. And among my brothers especially, who are seropositive, sometimes it's the virus that does that to your sexuality, but a lot of it has to do with something confused in our own heads in terms of the joy of our sexuality and the darkness of this illness having gotten mixed up in our heads. So that to seek intimacy again is just a very, very painful process. In any case, I wanted to show that disjunction and dysfunction, because I didn't feel anybody else had really talked about that in gay literature. The other sex scenes that you speak of involve the character of Sonny, who is the compulsive character in the book and who goes after a very tough, feelingless, compulsive sexuality I don't think it mirrors gay culture at large, but it mirrors a certain kind of disjunction between passion and love that a lot of gay and lesbian people suffer from because of the self-hatred of the closet that they grow up in. I think all of us have to learn a great deal in order to put together passion and feeling. It may be easier for straight people because those violins and that bottle of wine come with the territory starting when you're 12 years old. But I don't especially feel that the erotic scenes in my work are clinical, but they are graphic, so maybe we're saying the same thing. My model in all of this, after all, is Lawrence, and my rage at this point comes with the fact that I really do believe my First Amendment freedom is in great peril in this country. The fact that John Frohnmayer can say that he is comfortable with the Helms Amendment to the NEA granting process, which says that homoerotic scenes are not appropriate or cannot be in literature. Well, my answer to that is if all of us cannot be eligible for this money, then none of us can have this money, and we'll just have to dismantle his NEA, because homoeroticism is our version of those violins and that bottle of wine in the fireplace. It's different, and I know that straight readers, male and female, have a certain amount of discomfort with the openness of the sexuality in my novels, but I think discomfort can teach us a good deal, and I see people get past it also.
The romantic relationship between gays, I guess I'm asking a question that perhaps can't be answered, but I'm asking, how similar is it to heterosexual romance?
Well, I suppose
there's one place that was kind of startling in the book. Two men are in the process of or about to make love, and their beards clash. And you know, it's kind of hard for me to imagine my beard rubbing against the beard of another man. I don't know if you can answer that question. It may be
my sense
not answerable.
My sense is that gay and lesbian people are fully as romantic in their heads as heterosexual people. They also have the same kinds of trouble as the women who love too much and the Peter Pan men who can't love back. I think we all come from dysfunctional places. The dysfunctional family is an invention of the late 80s in psychology, but that's only because it's been there for all of us. We have a lot to learn about what television and the 50s taught us about what seemed so simple about loving. Loving is not simple. That moving remark of Thoreau's that the only cure for love is more love comes very close, I suppose, to the Christian concept that love is bountiful and must be opened more and more. This business of loving your neighbor as yourself, all of that becomes an idealism that's very far from the difficult experiences all of us have in our relationships. My parents had a marriage that lasted 48 years and was a model of joy and intimacy. And they made it possible. I always feel that the thing they gave best to my brother and me was somehow bringing us up in the light of that, so that my brother and me could both have relationships that made us happy. And my brother, who's been in a wheelchair all his life, found a wonderful woman, and they have a wonderful marriage. And I found Roger, and we had 12 very happy years together. That's really the luck of the draw, because most of my friends, gay or straight, by the time they come into their 30s and they're going through difficult divorces and difficult situations and beginning to doubt themselves, a lot of the cockiness of their own romanticism from their adolescent years and their college years has dwindled quite away.
There's something else I like very much in Afterlife, and that's the routine lives of the characters. For example, the process of preparing for Thanksgiving and making the turkey. It's very domestic. It's not unlike the lives of straight people. And it also is an indication that in spite of this terrible disease, James Purdy calls it the plague or the pest. He doesn't like to refer to it as a disease or AIDS. In spite of it, though, life goes on.
Yes, the Thanksgiving chapter, which is the second last chapter, was an enormously illuminating place for me, too. I had been writing at this book for 6 or 7 months when I got the idea of that Thanksgiving chapter. And when I got that idea, the book finally really began to make sense to me, and I began to be able to revise it towards that. And this very peculiar random family that comes together at Thanksgiving. All the characters in the book come together for this Thanksgiving dinner. There are 10 or 12 of them, and they are from all over the place. And there's the Korean man and the Hispanic brother and sister, and there's the cokehead wife of the TV star who's on her way to Betty Ford. And somehow they all managed to get this Thanksgiving dinner together. And I wanted to kind of give a Norman Rockwell burnish to what is in fact a very odd grouping of people, but that odd grouping of people is very much the urban context of what we call the gay family, the kind of chosen family that gay and lesbian people make when they come to the city. Can include people in the blood family, and certainly can include straight people, but there's something special about that chosen family.
The blood family. That's an
interesting. The blood family, I mean the families we all came from.
Oh, I see. Although you have written about AIDS, I don't know that you would necessarily characterize yourself as an expert on AIDS, but how do you suppose this terrible disease got so out of control?
I certainly feel, I may not be an expert on the disease, but I certainly feel like a historian of the condition. And there is no question in my mind that a lot of people had to make the decision to allow this to happen unconsciously. It's the Reagan government who really let this happen for during, you know, at least 5 or 6 years of his reign. And there's an international character to the wish for it all to go away that characterized the press's response from 81 to 85 and most governments' responses as well. I feel an immense amount of rage and bitterness about that. I've happily been able to channel that into political activism, and I'm a cockeyed optimist about where I think gay and lesbian life is going, because I think that we really are making our case. People are beginning to understand what homophobia is. And the people who feel it the most strongly aren't going to change, but I think we are beginning to make people understand the parallels between homophobia and anti-Semitism or racism. There was a distressing piece in Newsweek this week by Jonathan Alter in which he says, well, you certainly can't hate homosexuals. That is a terrible thing to do, but you can hate homosexuality. I don't think it's a distinction that would be made between Jews and Judaism, and certainly not between blacks and the black race. So we have a long way to go, an enormously long way to go. But I feel that we are beginning to have a literature. One of the things I feel like the Barbara Bush of gay life in one sense, because I'm always talking about gay and lesbian illiteracy. It troubles me deeply, just as it troubles the First Lady, that we are turning out a generation of MTV kids who can't read. And I especially feel that gay and lesbian people have to be able to read about themselves when they get into their 20s, because they've spent the whole first 20 years of their lives having no positive role models and no images and no history given to them. And we need to understand our history. We need to understand the story of the Pink Triangle in Nazi Germany. We need to understand the ways in which homophobia tries to split up men and women. Most of the stupid homophobic remarks that are made by the good Catholic boys like Andy Rooney come from this sense of upset about gay men. They don't tend to remember that there are lesbians as well, and that we, as a people, we are both men and women. I know that's all very far away from literature, but the literature that we are making as gay and lesbian people will, I hope, teach gay and lesbian people more of who they are. I mean, we need to solve our problems as gay and lesbian people about substance abuse and dysfunctional families as much as anybody else does in society.
And it's important, too, in these books, the books that you write, and Edmund White and Armistead Maupin and David Lovett, these are wonderful books and wonderful writers, and it also explains the gay world to straight people and lets them know what's going on and how they feel, and there is a humanity there, not just some isolated group. When did it become apparent among gays that AIDS was now in the gay community and out of control? And what happened when it became a reality to them?
In borrowed time, I try to take it back to the moment I first heard anything at all. And that would have been in January 1982. About 4 or 5 months after the first cases were reported to the CDC, there was an article in The Advocate. And the article said, "Is sex making us sick?" And I remember reading that article to my friend Roger as we were driving out to Palm Springs to visit his parents and just being horrified by it. And it was during that winter, at least a couple of years before we had any inkling that it was a virus and that we were, you know, passing it one to another. At that point, we understood how urgent the situation was and how the news would probably not be picking up all this. We had to find out all this ourselves. And I think it was during 1982 that people who were savvy and maybe a bit paranoid as well began to be frightened about what it all could be. The cases of, I mean, if you lived in a certain parts of Greenwich Village or went to Fire Island in the summer, you already were beginning to know people who died. It didn't enter my life until September 1st, 1983, when my best friend Cesar in San Francisco was diagnosed with KS. And I guess until that point, I truly believed I was going to keep it away from my life. I didn't feel as if I'd had so many contacts in the previous years. And in any case, who understood that it was going to be a virus that incubated for 10 years?
What about we read the obituaries now and we see a lot of people dying of AIDS and they're just now dying because they obviously contracted the disease 5, 6 years ago, although
or 10 or 15 years ago.
That long?
Yeah.
Have the sexual habits fairly significantly changed?
Well, the gay community has been the model of the 1,000 points of light in terms of educating the people within our community about safe sex, so that most of the curves for seroconversion from non-infected to infected have flattened out. I mean, if you look at that curve in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York, you see how few new conversion from seronegative to seropositive is happening. But it's very easy to become complacent, and I am equally worried about gay men 20 to 25 years old as I am about gay and straight teenagers, because they simply tend to think that they're immortal or that it's passed them by. That is a complacency we have seen in straight people all through the epidemic. And there is this glibness which says that there hasn't been an explosion of heterosexual cases in the United States in the last 10 years, and therefore everybody's safe. Well, everybody isn't safe. It may be that white men are safe for the time being, but of the 1.5 million people who are infected, remember, there are probably a couple of 100,000 people among them who are bisexual men. Unlike gay men, they are notoriously secretive about their sex lives. They do not tell the women that they sleep with that they also sleep with men, and that's why we're beginning to see so many straight women come into the clinics.
But in general, there has not been a major epidemic within the straight world, has there?
Not in this country. Not in this country. Other countries are showing much more dark statistics. But there are a lot of people who also feel that the gay community made a mistake pushing so hard in the last several years to say this is not a gay disease. Well, in fact, it is a gay disease because gay men are still dying of it more than anybody right now. It is becoming a third world disease in this country. Black and brown people are at the forefront of the infection rate. As writers, I think that gay people feel a profound urgency to leave a record the way I feel, and to also, there's some sense of how would you write about anything else at this point? I mean, I can see that maybe other people out there can write about something else, but for me to try to write about a world in which AIDS does not figure would be like trying to, I don't know, write an opera for the Berlin Opera in the middle of the Second World War, as a Jew.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely, well, that's a good analogy. It's if you're a writer and you are in the middle of, say, the Second World War, it would seem appropriate to write about that war, the most traumatic thing that's happening to the world at that time, or to anybody. I mean, almost every nation in the globe was somehow affected by that war. So there are plenty of war books that would come out of the 1940s. So it would certainly make sense that here is the AIDS generation, and this is the thing that affects us most.
And it's interesting to remember that the most influential book about the Second World War to come from within it was written by a 14-year-old girl. I mean, it is the fact of witnessing sometimes that gives you your most profound insight into what goes on. You know, my pang about illiteracy, but my hope is that 25 or 50 years from now, gay people especially, but anyone who wants to know how this all could have happened, how a government could have let this happen, how everyone could have had their heads in the sand for so many years. And I'm not sure that those heads aren't every bit as much in the sand. I mean, I think we like to hope that AIDS has become a kind of manageable situation because we have some antiviral medication out there. It's only marginally more manageable, and most people who need that medication aren't getting it because they don't even know to get it. And all of this becomes part of a health system which is falling apart. I have become the record that I try to tell in Afterlife involves a lot of AIDS support groups, because I went to a lot of AIDS support groups after Roger died, and those groups were full of all kinds of people from all walks of life who came to the Gay Community Center because nothing else was available to them. There were, you know, men and women, black and white, and so many of them spoke so passionately about, well, if I've only got a couple of years left, I want to fall in love. That's what the young ones would say. And people would speak of the fact that their careers didn't mean anything to them anymore. And there was such a longing for intimacy. I think that longing for intimacy is worldwide and cuts through all other groups. And at the pitch of life, if you feel that life is going to be taken from you in a year or two or three, it's the thing that seems most worth going after. That doesn't mean it's easy to find or easy to make happen.
Now, Paul, I think you said at the outset of this interview that you had tested positive for the virus. What went through your mind when you learned that?
Well, as I say, Don, I really assumed, because that was in the middle of Roger's illness, I was tested as soon as the test became available in June or July of 1985, and I just assumed that there would be a certain point where we would both be in different hospitals dying. But I happen to have, partly because of the fighting of people like Roger for these antiviral drugs, I have really benefited from them, so that here, 5 years later, my immune system, while very compromised, has not taken a nosedive. And that's why we're still fighting for antiviral medication to be released to us and for the research to be done. One of the stories that hasn't been told about AZT, a drug that has kept me going for the last 2 years, is that it really stops working after a while. After 2 years or 2.5 years, the virus mutates, something happens, and therefore we're going to, if we hope to manage this situation and turn it into something the way diabetes is managed by insulin, for instance, we're going to have better and better antivirals to come along. And the reason to do that is so that every hospital bed in America is not filled with someone dying of AIDS. It would really be to the culture's advantage, even economically, to work towards that solution. There are a lot of people out there who feel that AIDS is the solution. There's no need to come up with a solution if AIDS is the solution. Those people are clearly not going to read my books. But I always feel that I want my books to be open always to gay people, because I know that I write from within that experience and to try to explain that experience. But I always hope that people who are the loved ones of gay people, their friends, their families, long to understand more about the gay people they've been ignorant about all their lives. I think that is what I certainly noticed with Borrowed Time. Whether that can spill over to a book like Afterlife, which, as you say, is much more frankly erotic and much more frankly political, who knows?
Well, we need people like you, Paul and Manette, to explain these things. I hope you have many years ahead, because I know you have a lot more to say, and I want you to be around to say it.
Well, thank you, Don. I don't waste time, I have to tell you. I get to that typewriter every day.
Afterlife, it's a beautifully, beautifully written book, and it's very moving and very funny at the same time. Wonderful book. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Don.